It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by on-camera and voiceover talent rodhunter.com and the law offices of Matthew Simone. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist Bob Siegel.
Welcome to our program, a forum where all questions are welcome. And today I do have a very interesting question sent my way. I have edited the question slightly to omit any of the personal elements. Bob, during our home group Bible study meeting, we were reading Psalm 139 and came up with a question about the meaning of verse 8b. As you know, one Bible translation says, "If I make my bed in the depths, you are there." Another uses the word Sheol, and the King James Version uses the term hell. Our group would like to know how you interpret this, Bob. Does this mean that God or Christ goes to hell to be with his people? We would so appreciate any help you could give us. Good question, my friend. Excellent question. The phrase in Hebrew reads, "Make my bed in Sheol." Sheol was both the Hebrew word for hell and for a grave, usually the latter in those days. And it is not always clear how the ancient authors intended the use, but in this passage it may actually mean hell because of the context. Still, I must point out, in the Old Testament there was not as much of an emphasis on the afterlife. We are unable to gather a great deal of information from this one passage and must especially avoid developing any detailed theology from a poetic book such as Psalms. Poetry in the Bible served to make emotional statements rather than instruction statements. Fortunately, there's a lot of other stuff in the Old Testament aside from poetry. Daniel 12, for example, does provide a much more definitive teaching about a resurrection to everlasting life or everlasting destruction, and that is the most specific statement you will find in the Testament. Having said that, to address the important wrinkle in your home group's discussion, no, Christ does not dwell in hell with people. I know. I understand that sounds like it would be a nice and merciful thing for him to do, but be comforted because his real mercy, the things he really does do and did do, went far beyond anything human beings can imagine. More on that in a moment. Now, there is a section in 1 Peter chapter 3 describing Jesus going briefly during the time between his death on the cross and his resurrection, briefly to the evil angels who were imprisoned in a kind of spiritual jail or holding cell prior to being cast into the ultimate hell. Who were these angels? These were angels who wreaked havoc on the earth during the time of Noah preceding the flood. That's who Jesus is talking about here. It's kind of like jail and prison today. You go to jail, then you have your trial, then you go to prison. These angels are in jail. They have not yet had their trial. They have not yet gone to ultimate hell. But while we understand exactly who these angels were and why they were there, why Jesus was there with them is a little bit of a mystery. We're told that he preached to them. What exactly did he preach? What exactly did they hear? That we are not told, but we do know that his purpose was not to offer comfort, as these angels received no second chance and will still end up in hell. Best guess is he's proclaiming God's victory, proclaiming that they chose the wrong side, but we don't really understand what he said to them in so many words. However, there is good news for the spirit of your group's question. Perhaps the most significant thing Jesus did regarding hell was experiencing the pain of separation from God on our behalf. Ultimately, that is what hell is, separation from God. Whether or not it's a place where people really burn is debatable. We won't get into that today. I do have other podcasts which talk about it. But before Jesus died on the cross, he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" The second person of the Trinity, who is now in human form, has been separated from the other two persons of the Trinity. This is because God the Father saw our sin on Jesus. Of course, the metaphysics of that are not explained, but this is just exactly what happened. Jesus took our sin upon himself on our behalf. God looked at Jesus and God saw your sin. God looked at Jesus and God saw my sin. God looked at Jesus and God saw everybody's sin. Jesus experienced the punishment that we deserve for our sin so that we need not experience the punishment. Jesus experienced separation from God so that we will never need to experience separation from God, ultimate, permanent separation. In short, Jesus experienced hell so that you and I would never need to end up in hell. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious.
Bob now at 888-344-1170. That's toll free, 888-344-1170. Bob may have strong opinions, but he also likes to hear what you have to say.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Again, on my first tour of Israel back in the year 2008, including on this tour repeated visits to the old city of Jerusalem, I had asked a lot of people about Golgotha. That means the skull and is supposed to be the site of the crucifixion of Jesus. Most people responded to my query by telling me about Church of the Holy Sepulchre, a sacred place for Catholics. This beautiful building, which I did see, allegedly stands upon the site of both the death and resurrection of Jesus. I tend to doubt its authenticity. For one thing, the site was chosen as a result of a dream. Now, don't get me wrong. I do believe God can speak to people through dreams. Both the Old and New Testaments abound with such incidents. But in this particular case, the dream came from Emperor Constantine's mother after he made Christianity a legal religion of Rome. Now, Constantine himself seemed to know little about Christianity, and many debate whether or not his conversion was ever even genuine in the first place. He had a dream of his own, instructing him to build a cross before battling a contender for the throne. This was before he knew much about Christianity, but he obeyed the dream. He obeyed this vision in the dream. And after winning this battle by constructing a cross, well, you can guess the rest. Constantine now loved Christianity, but still knew little about it. Even theological discussions which argued about the Trinity were of no use to him. He commanded the clergy to settle the matter one way or the other, and made it clear that he did not care how they settled it. For this reason, I am a little more interested in the opinion of archaeologists and geographers than the dream of Constantine's mother. Another problem. Huge as Church of the Holy Sepulchre is, it seems a little too coincidental that the burial and crucifixion sites would be so close together. Yes, it all happened in Jerusalem, and yes, the city was rebuilt by the Byzantines, who unfortunately did put up many buildings over historical sites, and whereas the area in and around the old city is certainly not huge, these locations now revered by the Catholics still seem a bit too close. Protestant pilgrims tend to go to other places, still in Jerusalem, but without enormous church structures on top. For my third tour with Jacob, our Jewish tour guide, I posed the question of the crucifixion once again, this time making it clear that I was not interested in Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I once saw a picture of a hill that looked like a human skull, Jacob. Can you take me there? Well, he did. And yes, indeed, it looked like a skull, all right. Jacob also took me to the Protestant Tomb of Jesus, a first century hollowed out cave. Many such caves were used by wealthy people as a resting place for their loved ones. In the Bible, we are told that Joseph of Arimathea purchased the body of Jesus and gave him a rich man's grave. Jacob left me for just a few minutes so I could have some time to myself as I stood inside this cave, known as a sepulcher, not Church of the Holy Sepulcher, but a real honest-to-goodness sepulcher, I found myself wishing for more time, but there were many other places Jacob was anxious to show me. I did, however, get to revisit this location and go inside and spend more time when I returned to Israel later in the year 2017. Can we say for sure that I was actually inside the tomb of Jesus? No. But if this was not the exact same sepulchre, Jesus did lay in a tomb just like it and not far from here, so it was still pretty awesome. Besides, a site that special and holy to Christians would have been remembered by someone. It's not like Jesus was some unknown figure of history, and yet, during the period of the Byzantines, who was going to argue with Constantine's mother? Maybe some guy who no longer cared if his head and shoulders were connected? Not far from the tomb, but not as close as the tomb and crucifixion locations in the Catholic site, we looked at a hilltop shaped like a skull. This was indeed the place I asked Jacob to take me, a place first discovered by British General Gordon in 1883. I asked Jacob if there was any record of this hill having its landscape changed by erosion or earthquakes in the last 2,000 years. He said no. And remember, Jacob was not a Christian. He had no vested interest in this hill one way or the other. Call me a romantic, but if the Bible says that Jesus was executed on a hill called the Skull, and if there is in fact a hill shaped like a skull not far from a first century sepulcher, chances are we have located the real site of Jesus's crucifixion. This means I saw the actual place where my own sins had visited Israel once before, the hill where my Messiah and Savior took my sins, and not mine only, but the sins of the entire world. This is Bob Siegel, making the obvious, even when the obvious is incredibly incredible. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric.
Looking for a book you won't be able to put down? Push the Winds Around is a romance set in the context of science fiction. Dr. Brandon Krieger is given the opportunity of a lifetime, a psychologist's dream. Through the usage of his physics professor friend's time machine, Brandon travels 20 years back through time in an attempt to change one man's destiny. Tom Kyle, a convicted and unremorseful murderer, is located in the past when he was a 6-year-old boy. Brandon's mission? To alter Tom Kyle's path and prevent him from being a vicious killer. Matters are complicated when Brandon finds himself falling in love with young Tom's mother. Push the Winds Around, a novel by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
My friends, today I come to you solemnly, with my heart in my hands. I freely confess a phenomenon that has amazed and astounded me. I suspect this is a problem with males more than females, but I must confess, I have absolutely no idea how my socks used to disappear. Yes, you heard me correctly, socks. I'm talking about ordinary socks, those items of clothing that you wear under your shoes. They used to disappear. They used to disappear all the time. Now, I'm not a magician. I can't do tricks. I don't pull rabbits out of a hat, but I used to pull off the disappearing socks trick, and quite frequently. I say used to for a reason. I'm married now. I suppose any attempt to flatter my wife and say that women do better with laundry than men will be viewed as some kind of horrible, thoughtless chauvinism. So be it. I really do intend for this discussion right now to be nothing more than an indictment of my own carelessness, although I must insist I have no idea how the carelessness works, and it does at times seem like other outside forces might possibly be at play. Let me share with you my simple bachelor routine from the past, and I'll just bet other bachelors can relate. It goes like this. I do a load of laundry. After taking my clothes out of the dryer, I find that I only washed one pair of socks when I had been quite certain that two or three pairs were put in. Or I put in one pair, but only one of the two socks in the pair comes out of the dryer. His twin brother is nowhere in sight. I've had many years to think about this, so for a while, there was a workable theory. It had to do with quantum physics, the origin of the universe, and the altering of our space-time continuum. More specifically, how those puzzles intersect with the Bermuda Triangle, hijacking its properties long enough to replicate a miniaturized, yet similar phenomenon that connects to all washers and dryers. No? Okay. Fine. I challenge you to offer a better explanation, because my only solution back in those days was heading off to Walmart for more socks. Now, I should say, in the passage of time, a far more plausible theory has been entertained in the quiet of the night when I do my best meditation. And mark my words, this one will be difficult to argue with. Ready? Here we go. It's really so simple. So simple. Why didn't I ever think of this before? When you wash a pair of socks, when you physically remove both socks from the washer and place them in the dryer in front of eyewitnesses, in the presence of eyewitnesses who could verify your actions in a sworn affidavit, when you nevertheless open the dryer later only to discover one sock, not two, there is only one explanation for the one sock: global warming. How can a disappearing sock be caused by global warming, you ask? Silly. Everything is caused by global warming, so that must include socks. It only stands to reason. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious. This is Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Looking for a place where you can be yourself without having to act more spiritual than you really are? Looking for a church where you can have the dynamics of a large worship service, but the intimacy of a small group? Why not try Skyline Church, located in Rancho San Diego by 94 in Hamasha? I know you'll enjoy the preaching. You can also get to know people through a midweek small group. And for those who want to dig deeper into the Bible, a whole series of classes are offered on Sunday mornings. I teach one of them myself, Forbidden Table Talk, same name as my column, a time to bring up any Bible-related question at all. I would love to see you there. Now, I'm not saying Skyline doesn't have other good classes that you could take as an alternative to mine. I'm just saying don't take any of those. Take Forbidden Table Talk. Actually, you'll enjoy any experience you choose at Skyline Church.
Skyline Church.
Welcome back to 1170 AM, 96.1 FM, The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Always good to be joined by my faithful producer, Brendan Thomas. Brendan, what's on your radar today?
Well, thank you, Bob. How are you doing tonight, by the way?
I'm doing okay.
Awesome, awesome. Comedy on your sock monologue from earlier. I remember watching Shark Tank, which is a show about entrepreneurs trying to show off products to billionaires to see if they can invest in their business. And one guy invented the thrice, which is not one, not two, but three socks in one package. So that way, if you lose one. Exactly. I was thinking, man, he's got a good point. And then the billionaires were like, well, do you have a patent in on it? Because if not, sock companies will just take over over you. And I was like, oh, I don't have that. So,
but well, and I know it's not me. I've heard other people talk about this for years. It's quite a phenomenon.
I know. For most of my socks, they just get really holy. And I'm like, okay, I need to throw them away now. Or I turn them into a dust kind of thing. So anyways, today I wanted to talk about a movie that just recently came out, and I got to see it on Friday, which was Elvis.
I have seen that advertised. I have not seen the movie. I don't know anything about it. I do normally like these biography movies, this making of the man kind of movie. So yeah, tell us about it.
Well, I personally, I'm more of a fan of documentary style kind of biofilms.
Like really? Oh, yes. I like the kinds where there's actors and things.
Really?
And even though they take liberties, if it's well done enough, enough, it just inspires me to go out and research the more documentary style.
I understand. I just like the authenticity that comes off of documentaries. Like, wow, that's how this artist really acted there, or other situations that'll come about in those artists' lives.
As long as the people doing the drama are admitting that they took liberties, I don't have a problem. If it's somebody like Oliver Stone that swears every word is true when he can't really back it up, that's another story.
Yeah, different story entirely. So this was directed by Baz Luhrmann. I'm not a huge fan of him as a director. I haven't seen Strictly Ballroom, which was his first film. I definitely seen Romeo and Juliet. I didn't like that rendition very much. That was the one with Leonardo DiCaprio. And
was that the one that was set more in modern times?
Correct, yeah.
So it was West Side Story without the music, basically.
Exactly, yeah. Set in modern 90s time, but they still used old English with their dialect and everything. It was creative, I'll give it that, but unfortunately, I don't think it really worked well in terms of a whole movie experience.
Well, wouldn't using the old English kind of defeat the purpose of setting it in modern times?
It was supposed to be a stylistic representation, like a different kind of style to the whole film. And I, for me, it just didn't work out for me. But I understand if other people like it.
Stylistic or stupid, as some of us call it.
Yes, exactly. After that, he did Moulin Rouge. I'm not a huge fan of that movie.
I didn't care for that because it wasn't a true musical. They just used pop music that already existed and incorporated. I like a musical where they write the songs just for that
story. Some original stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. I don't mind the songs that they chose in the movie, personally.
No, there was no problem with that. It was just the fact that they were using outside music. Plus, yeah. I didn't think it was a great story.
I was going to get that, too. I was going to say the story, to me, was also very weak. And
what it did accomplish is it brought back the movie musical, because the movie musical was all but dead before Moulin Rouge came along. So I did appreciate that.
Absolutely. And look how many good movie musicals came that afterwards.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
I will give that credit. But again, I personally think there's better movies you could watch if you want a movie musical than Moulin Rouge. After that, he did Australia, which that had Hugh Jackman in the starring role. And
Hugh Jackman's a great actor, but I don't know anything about this particular movie.
He's, as a singer, though, that's a different story. I'm not a huge fan of
him. Well, did you see him in
Greatest Showman?
Yeah, I thought his singing was okay.
No, I couldn't stand it.
I loved Greatest Showman.
You liked
the movie. Didn't like his singing.
Hugh Jackman's scene is just not very
well. Fortunately
taste.
For you, there were other people that sang.
That's
also
right.
That, and some of them were phenomenal singers.
I know.
That woman that was supposed to be the operetta singer. She was fantastic.
Absolutely. Maybe we should do a whole movie review on that one next time. But
yeah, that was quite the story. I really enjoyed that movie.
Yeah, but that wasn't totally true, I bet, right?
They took liberties, but certainly they were catching the spirit of P.T. Barnum. Yeah. Absolutely.
And then lastly, after that, he did The Great Gatsby.
Didn't see that.
I love the book. The book is really, really good. I had to read that during my middle school years when
the only thing I remember about that book is when Andy Kaufman went to Arizona State University and he messed with the people, and instead of doing a stand-up comedy, he read the entire novel Great Gatsby, and there were like a whole 10 people still in the theater when he was done.
It sounds like an Andy Kaufman
thing. Oh, that's exactly the kind of thing Andy Kaufman would do. And we laugh about it now, but the people that paid money to go and hoping they were going to be entertained, they were
not.
Are
you kidding me? I would love to pay $20.
Well, it would just 40, if you understand that messing with their heads is part of his style,
he's supposed to be anti-humor. It's funny because it's not supposed to be funny. That's the whole shtick of him.
You just got to give him credit for originality and daring. But anyway, I'm getting us on a tangent.
No.
But
it's perfect.
That was my experience with The Great Gatsby.
No.
Watching on film Andy Kaufman doing that, and of course Jim Carrey in the movie Man in the Moon did a rendition of that scene too.
So I didn't see that.
I've seen both. I've seen the real Andy Kaufman, or at least a snippet of it, doing the real reading. Oh, you should see the movie Man in the Moon. I'm not a big Jim Carrey fan. He did a phenomenal job. After a while, you really think you're watching Andy Kaufman.
Is it more dramatic, it sounds like?
Got drama, but a lot of humor in it, too. Okay. It's really, it's excellent. Directed by Danny DeVito. It's a wonderful movie.
Really? I'm imagining a lot of dark humor in that, because most of Danny DeVito's movies have a lot of dark humor.
The only flaw in it is they went through his days with Taxi, and they brought in the real Taxi actors, but they were so much older than they would have looked in the time that they're filming that it didn't work too well, even though I appreciated they were trying to be authentic.
I'll take a look and see.
Oh, my gosh. I loved it. I loved Man on the Moon. And he won the Golden Globe Award for Best Actor in that role.
Oh, a Jim Carrey did?
Jim Carrey did,
nice.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So going back to The Great Gatsby, the movie itself, I think production-wise, it's really stylistic, really cool looking. I think the actors tried their very best, but in terms of doing a rendition to that novel, it's not very good. But as per usual, you know, the novel's usually better than the movies.
I really think the miniseries is the best vehicle for dramatizing a novel. A whole novel done as a two-hour movie usually just cannot possibly work.
I'm trying to think of any miniseries that were better than the books too. Now
I don't know about them being better, but being just as good. The Winds of War and War and Remembrance were excellent. Roots was, I thought the dramatization of Roots was better than the novel.
See, I think the novel's better. I don't mind the dramatization of it because I thought it was really good too, but the novel of Roots I think is still a little bit better between the two.
That's, well, of course you have the novelty of that novel. There's never been a novelty, novel written like that before, and the true research he did to look up his own roots was fantastic.
Absolutely. So getting into this Elvis movie, I would say I was kind of mixed on it because on the one hand, I am a huge fan of Elvis Presley. I think as an entertainer, there's nobody that was like him ever in our entire lives. Like,
he's an interesting enigma because I remember when the Beatles came out, and this is, I grew up in the 60s. When the Beatles came out, Elvis became a has-been. And we just all assumed that for decades to come, people would be talking about the Beatles. Mm-hmm. But you can meet people today who don't even know who the Beatles are, or at the very most, they have just a vague understanding of them. And Elvis just became huger and huger and huger over the years. So he is definitely considered, I'm not a huge Elvis fan, but he is definitely considered the king of rock and roll.
Yeah.
And he far eclipsed the Beatles and anybody that ever came after.
Especially if you look at how many records he sold throughout his whole career. I mean, there's nobody else that compares to him at all when it comes to that. Kind
yeah,
of numbers,
and then so. He made those movies. And then, of course, he got drafted. They made a whole Broadway musical turned into a movie called Bye Bye Birdie that was supposed to be about Elvis being drafted. Only they changed the name of the rock singer in the movie. They called him Comrade Birdie. But it was really the story of Elvis being drafted into the army.
Okay, because the movie says it kind of differently here. So the movie stars Austin Butler as Elvis and Tom Hanks as Colonel Tom Parker. Those two guys put in a performance of a lifetime. I'm
Tom Hanks
you.
Is always good.
I even talked to Shelley, my wife, after the movie, and I went, is there a movie where Tom Hanks didn't act well at all?
Like, now, there are Tom Hanks movies that I did not like,
yes,
but
yes.
I still would say that he did a very good job of acting in those movies.
Joe versus the Volcano for me, personally.
I hated that.
I know.
But that doesn't mean Tom Hanks wasn't good.
He was really good
in
it.
He did the best he could with horrible material.
I'm trying to think of one movie at all in Tom Hanks's filmography. I know you don't like Forrest Gump, but I think he puts in a really good performance.
He does, but I still can't stand that.
I know. I know. Did you hear that they made a Bollywood remake of Forrest Gump? It just came out this weekend.
A remake?
Uh-huh.
Who stars in the role?
It's an Indian remake.
Oh, remake.
Yeah, it's an Indian one. It's from India, and it's a Forrest Gump remake. I haven't got a chance to see it because I don't have 3.5 hours to sit down.
Now, do they call it Forrest Gump, or is it just a similar story?
No, it's under another title, but I don't want to say the title because it's I don't want to butcher the dialect or anything like that. But anyways, Austin Butler, honestly, when you're watching the movie, you're almost thinking that that is the real Elvis, in all honesty. He really does do a good job. Tom Hanks, of course, does a really good job. Helen Thompson plays Elvis's mom, and she does a really, really nice job. And there's also Richard Roxburgh. He's
now, you said Helen Thompson. That's not Emma Thompson?
No, not Emma Thompson.
I guess I'm not
Helen
familiar.
Thompson.
I'm not familiar with
I'm not familiar with her on the top of my head, but all I know is that she really stood out really huge time player in this movie. So performances are all fantastic. I love the production again because it's really stylish.
Now, does it start like at the beginning of his life and how he rose to fame and then how everything fell apart?
It starts like usual where you start in the middle of the film. Like, he's
collapsed. Do they do a lot of flashbacks in it?
They start off on a flashback until you get back to your original scene and everything.
I like flashbacks if they have them in one place or two. If they keep jumping back and forth between flashbacks and the present, people get lost.
A lot of indie films do that for
I know, they're being cute with the camera and the technique, I think the audience would prefer a more linear story.
This was definitely linear, although it's very strange at the same time, because you'll occasionally cut to Colonel Tom Parker, who's, I guess, in his deathbed, but he's also in the casino as a really
old
man.
Now, is that someone Elvis knew when he was drafted into the military, this colonel, or is this just, okay.
Yeah. Well, so what happens is, the whole point of the story is to tell tell it from Colonel Tom Parker's side.
Oh, I see.
Which is a kind of a different way of looking at the Elvis story. And I'm like, okay. So, and he's like, I didn't. A lot of people say I killed Elvis, but here's how I didn't. Unfortunately, I would say the story doesn't do a very good job convincing me that it wasn't Colonel and Tom Parker's fault. So the movie actually begins with Colonel Tom Parker is with a very famous country artist, and he's starting to lose crowds, and he's like, I need a next new young talent. And the country artist's son starts playing this other kind of artist, and he's like, what is that? And he says, well, that's what the new kids are all listening to. And he's hearing it from teenager cars, like left and right in the parking lot. And so they go to try to find this guy, and they're able to find him, and they bring him on to a radio station to perform live on the air. And he's all dressed up in pink, an outfit, and he has eye makeup on. And as soon as he starts shaking his hips, all the girls in the crowd are going extremely wild. And the guys are like, I don't know how to feel about this guy. This guy's pretty weird. And all of a sudden, Colonel Tom Parker is like, oh, I can make money off of this. So he makes him sign an exclusive contract, and he has his father become his business manager. And I believe all of this stuff is so far so true. I'm like believing most of what they're saying. They do cut away one more time just to show that what he was like as a child, because he was growing up in Tulupo, Mississippi. Is that right?
I'm not sure. Not familiar with that term.
Okay. I know it's in Mississippi, and he was hanging, and he actually had to live in a ghetto area. And so during that time, he grew up with a lot of black music. So that's how he got to hear a lot of blues music and R&B music. And he started to really, really enjoy that. Oh, and gospel music. That was a huge aspect of his music as well. And so what he decided to do was, from that point on, he decided to start covering a lot of these songs, and actually grew a market in Memphis, Tennessee. And it started to spread all over America. So all that, I'm like, okay, I can follow through on everything what you're saying to me. I question a little bit about the validity of whether these black artists really accepted him. Now, I'm not saying like he wasn't friends.
Well, back then, maybe. Today, they'd claim he was hijacking their culture.
That's what I was
cultural thinking. Appropriation. There was no such term back in those days. That's just a new woke idea.
Like they have a guy playing B.B. Keen in the movie, and he's like, dude, you should do a cover of this song. It'll sell better than me, obviously, because you're a white guy and you're...
Back in those days, a black man that was being imitated by a white man, that was viewed as a compliment. That was viewed as a homage to their culture.
Really? Because
I don't mean the ridiculous things like wearing blackface. I just mean just things about the culture that they appreciated.
I understand that. I just thought during the time, I thought they were pretty upset with him, I thought.
They
were stealing his music.
I suppose that may be as far as Elvis was concerned, but I'm just saying, I know in general, in those times, there wasn't this big movement about cultural appropriation.
Gotcha.
Whether Elvis personally had some issue with some people over that, that's very possible. I don't know much about the man.
I gotcha. Okay. So this leads up to one of my cons in the movie. The very first hour of this movie moves at such a brisk pace. The editing is flashy and it's in your face, and you're like, whoa, 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 slow down. And then all of a sudden, 2 hours start slowing down
You're moving over a lot of years, I think you need to start slow and get to know the characters, and then maybe later start moving up the pace if you have a whole lifetime to get through. But you have to slow it down enough somewhere to get into the characterization of
people,
or you won't care about the people.
A good example of that is Priscilla is in the movie, but you barely get to know her. They get to meet all of a sudden randomly, and they have a daughter all of a sudden, and they get married. I would love to get to know some more background.
That's going way too fast.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Another thing I didn't really like was they integrated some hip-hop music into the movie itself. Hip-hop wasn't created.
Of course, long before there was any hip-hop.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You could probably put it into the credits, but into the actual movie, it doesn't integrate very well because you're in the middle of the 50s right now. And again,
some bozo on the board must have thought that was a way to appeal to the present-day audience or something, but it sounds like a lame decision.
I agree. I would say still, overall, knowing about the history of Elvis, and at least with the history that I know of, I still think this movie does a pretty decent job. There's a lot of lines that are repeated over and over again from Colonel Tom Parker, where he's like, oh, all these hippies started to put really bad political thoughts in his head, because this was during the time of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. being shot, Robert Kennedy being shot as well.
And I don't believe Elvis was quite as big during those days of the latter 60s.
They said during those things, he was filming the comeback special
that was supposed
to come on. Yeah. Originally, the comeback special was supposed to be just a holiday special, but Elvis convinced the studio, no, I want to do my own thing. And Colonel Tom Parker got really upset with him during this whole situation. And I'm not sure whether they're saying Colonel Tom Parker wasn't for civil rights either. I'm kind of confused on that kind of muddle message. Every time one of those kind of events came by, he turned off the TV and he's trying to talk to Elvis like, hey, we need to do this advertising or this sponsorship in order for us to make some money around here and blah, blah, blah. Not entirely sure if they're trying to hint that he was being racist or if he was against these kind of civil rights things. Maybe for the time he was, and now he would have been different. But either way, I would say this is definitely his best movie, Baz Luhrmann's best movie. But I'm still giving it a mixed review. I think there's better representations of Elvis. And again, I will not deny Austin Butler and Tom Hanks do a fantastic job.
Well, it's too bad because he's such a phenomenon that a really good biography of his life is called for.
I think so too. So overall, I was going to give it a 7 out of 10, but now talking about it, I think I'm going to go down to a 6 out of 10. But I
just talking about it and
just talking about it now. Yeah, I was
helped you lower the score. Huh?
Yeah, heavy 6, light 7 in that area. If you are interested, it will come out. It's still in theaters, but it'll come out on DVD in about a couple weeks from now. So if you want to go listen to it, then you're more than welcome to go listen to it or watch it. Excuse me. You'll definitely enjoy the performances. Their Elvis rendition songs are fantastic. Austin Butler does a great impression of him, and he could sing very well and project.
Now, at the end of the movie, during the credits, do they play music from the real Elvis off the real soundtrack? That's usually
they actually integrate actual footage of Elvis during his last performance he ever did before he passed away at the age of 42, if I remember right his age. That's what the movie said. So again, decent movie. If you want to go out and watch it, go for it. Now I'm going to transition into something a little bit more serious. We had a House of Representatives from Florida have a speech over at the Turning Point USA Student Action Summit. It was a rally down in Florida, and this is Matt Gaetz. He was talking about the recent abortion ruling that happened at the Supreme Court. So let's take a listen together.
Our America is a pro-life nation, proudly. Have you watched these pro-abortion, pro-murder rallies? The people are just disgusting. Like, why is it that the women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions? Nobody wants to impregnate you if you look like a thumb. These people are odious on the inside and out. They're like 5'2", 350 pounds, and they're like, give me my abortions or I'll get up and march and protest. And I'm thinking, march? You look like you got ankles weaker than the legal reasoning behind Roe versus Wade. A few of them need to get up and march. They need to get up and march for like an hour a day, swing those arms, get the blood pumping, maybe mix in a salad.
So when he was asked to make sure if his comments were correct, he was interviewed by a local news station, and here is his comments after that incident happened.
It's just pure ugliness, and I see that ugliness on the inside. I see it on the outside. You know, even in the horrible circumstance where an abortion may happen, it is nothing to celebrate, and it is nothing to cheer.
Mm-hmm. Is it safe to say that based off of your comments, you're suggesting that these women at these abortion rallies are ugly and overweight?
Yes.
What do you say to people who think that those comments are offensive?
Be offended.
So I understand that before this whole incident happened, we've been having some issues with people who were for abortions. They were actually going up to judges' house and threatening their lives. I was seeing a bunch of graffiti as well everywhere. And actually, some of these protests were actually getting very violent and escalating to that point as well. So that's no excuse for any of their actions, in my opinion. But however, you're still a politician and you're representing part of America, and to have to insult them personally like that is a very, very, I would say, one of the most diabolical things you can do as a politician. You shouldn't stoop to their level of, oh, I'm just going to body shame you and everything. That is very despicable of him to do that, in my opinion.
Yeah, I completely agree, and it's quite a shame because up to now I have liked Matt Gaetz. I've liked the stands he takes. I'm very much anti-abortion and pro-life, mm-hmm. but I think you lose the argument when you start insulting insulting what people look like. For one thing, that has absolutely nothing to do with the point you're making, and it deters you from making your point. But also, it's rude, it's cruel, it's completely inexcusable. And the fact that the next day he wasn't even willing to do any personal reflection and say, you know, I was in front of the crowd, I got a little bit carried away, I regret some of the things I said. He could have said that and in a classy way apologized, and he didn't do that when given opportunity. So that's really too bad.
Yeah, absolutely. But at the same time, I mean, I'm kind of iffy on Matt Gaetz personally, especially with the whole investigation behind him. Do you know about the investigation behind
him?
No,
what is the investigation behind Matt Gaetz?
He's apparently under investigation for sex trafficking, specifically 17-year-old really? Girls. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, and now I assume the jury's still out on that. Obviously, if he's really doing that, then that's despicable. But if he's being accused of that because he's a conservative and they're trying to nail him for something, that's another story.
It does include the fact that there's 21 other conservative Republicans in this case, too. And if that, again, like what you're saying, if this is all true, because this is still being under investigation.
These days, when I see all the stuff they manufactured on Trump, I'm very dubious. But obviously, if he really did those kinds of things, he should step down from office immediately.
Yeah.
And he should be in jail.
So he actually also, going back to those comments, the abortion comics earlier, he also mentioned a specific social media presence woman decided to protest against what he said about her because she is a little bit of a bigger stature. She decided to raise money for a pro-abortion campaign, and she was actually able to raise over $1 million. And this pro-abortion campaign was to help women who were seeking for abortions in anti-abortion states, or at least try to help support them in some sort of way, whether it be food or other monetary reasons. The thing is, again, as a politician, like I said earlier, you really do need to make sure you're representing not only just you, but you're representing the whole country. And I hate to say this too, I really do, but Joe Biden is representing our country, and I don't think he has ever personally like attacked people yet at all in terms of like...
Oh, he attacks when he calls them racists. That's an attack on people and their character.
Who do you call racist?
Well, any black person that doesn't want to vote for him.
Oh, right. I remember that. I'm sorry.
He started his campaign by saying that Donald Trump went and defended the Ku Klux Klan, which Donald Trump did not do. I have studied that speech extensively.
Yeah.
It was a downright lie. He's insulted people constantly. Has he walked up to women and called them ugly? Probably not.
No, definitely not.
Not that kind of insult.
I remember we played that clip of when he was being interviewed by Charlemagne, and he mentioned, if you're not voting for me, then you're not black.
And you ain't even black, man.
That didn't help.
His other brilliance just illuminates the room.
Yeah, I know. So, okay, let me rephrase my statement earlier and say that Joe Biden hasn't attacked a woman for her shape or for...
I don't believe he has done that. And those are really cheap shots. And it gets us off the real discussion. We talk about women's rights. We talk about what women look like, insults. We should be talking about whether the life inside is just that, a life. That's the only legitimate discussion to be having here. And it gets lost in the sea of all this other stuff.
Yeah, I know. Speaking of which, did you hear about the Super Tuesday results in Kansas? I was surprised by this, to be honest. They were going to exterminate abortion rights entirely, and yet they voted not to, actually. If you definitely look at the map, it's Wichita, it's the big major cities that voted for the no, and then all the rural areas have voted for yes, let's get rid of abortions entirely in our state. But it definitely surprised me, because for the most part, I think Kansas is a mostly conservative state.
Yeah, Wichita is probably to Kansas what Austin is to Texas.
I didn't think of it that way.
Yeah, it's probably a parallel there.
Both are college towns.
Of course.
Have really young people or really young population living there. So I didn't think of it that way. Yeah. I thought it was quite interesting. What other Super Tuesday actions happened? We had a whole bunch of Trump-appointed candidates actually win their Super Tuesday votes.
Yes, already. And win against candidates to run again who had voted for Trump's impeachment. So
exactly.
The roosters are coming home.
I know. What was your comment? I think either last week or 2 weeks ago, you were saying how the Senate might be a little bit iffy, but the House of Representatives.
Well, it's always a little harder to take back the Senate than the House. Mm-hmm. I think we will take back the Senate. I think we'll take the House back by a landslide. It will probably be closer in the Senate. Now, I don't have a great record for political predictions. I'm very good at predicting what politicians are trying to do and where they stand and mm-hmm. what their devious plans are. What will end up getting carried out? I'm not as good at predicting that as someone
really,
like, say, Mike Friedenberg.
I was going to say, he is great.
He is great.
Yeah, so now looking at how those Super Tuesday results happened, I wouldn't be surprised if you're predictions correct. I wouldn't think that the Senate, again, like you said, might be a very difficult. I wouldn't be surprised if it turns red, but definitely the House of Representatives is going
to
change.
But if it's by a thin margin and we have to trust people like Mitt Romney to toe the line for us, whoopty frickin' do.
Oh, and don't get me started on, he's not the only one that you're going to be like, oh, great, here he is.
Right. No, there's Lisa Murkowski. There's others. Yeah.
The name goes on and on and
they go on. Yeah, they do.
But you know what? You might be onto something, Bob. We're definitely going to have some changes coming up, I think, in a couple years from now.
We need to. I just don't think our country can survive another 2 years under the Democrats. We're barely surviving the year and a half they've been in power.
Look at our economy and look at the...
And we still won't have the presidency, and there's still havoc you can run with the Justice Department, case in point, what happened in Florida last week.
Mm-hmm.
But it will help if we could at least take Congress back.
And after 59 straight days, our gas prices just went up again. I wonder what Joe Biden's going to have for an excuse.
I predict they'll go down a little again, oh, say a week before the beginning of November, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, okay. Well, thank you so much for this time again. And this was
Brendan, it's always
conversation.
A pleasure having you, my friend. You do a great job. You bring up great issues. We'll see you next week, everybody.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by the law offices of Matthew Simone.